This is a Republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Mark Brewer. Welcome to the Scum, Vermin, Smurfs, and Smackdowns edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. The heat keeps building in Republican politics. Trump refers to Americans who disagree with him as communists, fascists, Marxists, and vermin. Rhetoric that more than mirrors the horrible words of Adolf Hitler 90 years ago. Republican members of Congress continue to throw insults and fists at each other. One senator even tries to turn a Senate hearing into a cage match, only to have Bernie Sanders play peacemaker. Kevin McCarthy allegedly sucker punches one of the eight Republicans who voted to dump him as Speaker. And the Republican-controlled House Ethics Committee comes to the shocking conclusion that George Santos is a crook and a liar.
I'm Jeff Timmer. The big Michigan political story this week, the stunning decision by Flint Congressman Dan Kildee to retire from Congress. Dan's been a guest on this podcast, and he will be missed regardless of one's political positions. Dan Kildee has respect across the aisle. We'll be joined later in the podcast by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Stephen Henderson to talk about the sudden end of a mini political dynasty. Also this week, Trump says it out loud. A second Trump presidency would mean the end of Democratic rule as he uses the federal government to shut down dissent. Michigan's presidential primary will be February 27, and Donald Trump likely will be on the ballot, despite Mark's best efforts. We'll talk more about that, too. The MAGA-controlled Ottawa County Board of Commissioners is looking at spending $4 million to get rid of the county's health director. Would-be Democratic U.S. Senate nominee Hill Harper claims he has no bank accounts, no income, and no assets, even though he's loaned his campaign nearly $500,000, owns two homes, and at least one business. Ohio Republicans are trying to figure out how to cancel the statewide vote in support of the Reproductive Rights Constitutional Amendment, another example of Republicans trying to overturn an election. We'll defer the discussion of Kildee for a moment and start with the never-ending nightmare that is Donald Trump. Mark, your effort to keep Donald Trump off the Michigan primary ballot was rebuffed in court. What now?
First of all, Jeff, with all due respect to your introductory remarks, we are going to get Trump off the ballot. I don't want to be associated with those remarks. So just to be clear to all of our listeners. So yes, unfortunately this week, a court of claims judge dodged the question. He basically said, but courts can't decide this. This is a so-called political question, and it should be decided by Congress, which frankly is a disaster because that means the question of Trump's eligibility will not be decided until after he's could be elected, which is a prescription for chaos. So we have immediately appealed. We appealed to the Court of Appeals within 24 hours of that decision. And yesterday, we appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court to take the case directly. They can do that and have done that in important cases in the past because time is so short. The primary is February 27th. Ballots have to be available by mid-January, which means they have to get printed. And so we need a decision on this as quickly as possible. And frankly, whatever the Michigan Supreme Court decides, we may end up in front of the United States Supreme Court. So time is of the essence, and we have asked the Michigan Supreme Court to expeditiously hear this case and send it back to the Court of Claims judge for an evidentiary hearing. We need a short evidentiary hearing where we'll make our case as to why Trump engaged in insurrection and rebellion. I think it's obvious to everybody from so many evidentiary sources. But we need to make that case in court, and we're eager to have the opportunity to do that. So that's where we stand today, Jeff. But this is changing day by day, and we'll see what happens in the next week or so.
You know where my sentiments lie, and I guess I should learn not to make legal conclusions without consulting with you first, because my take on it was not quite accurate. One question I would have, is it possible that we could see some kind of Solomon-like move like we saw in Minnesota, where with regard to the primary, that is determined to be what would amount to a party function in who Donald Trump could appear on the ballot for the primary, but let the courts have a little longer time to determine whether or not he could appear on a general election ballot. Is that even is that a possibility in Michigan, given Michigan law and the fact the state runs the primary as the election administrator?
That's certainly one possibility. One of the other things our judge did this week was take cover under the Minnesota decision and say, look, this is a primary. It's really for the parties to decide who their candidates are. That may be correct as a matter of Minnesota law, but it's not correct under Michigan law. We have very well-established law here that voters have a right to only have eligible candidates on the ballot, and they can bring suits like we did to strike ineligible candidates. So we don't want the parties to just be able to commandeer the primary process. Under the court's analysis here, Barack Obama could be put on the ballot by the Democratic Party. George Bush could be put on the primary ballot by the Republican Party, even though they are obviously ineligible under the 22nd Amendment. But that can't be. It cannot be that the political parties can put plainly ineligible people like Donald Trump on the ballot. There's a role here for the courts, and we hope that the Michigan Supreme Court will step up and take a look at that case.
That's a fascinating take, and it's like going to law school, I imagine. We're learning a lot here. No, it's. I think that's a very compelling argument. If I wish I was on the Supreme Court right now, I know how I'd vote.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that vote. We're going to make our best case. As you and I record here on Friday afternoon, we are awaiting the direction from the Supreme Court as to what the Michigan Supreme Court wants to do next.
Yep. Mark, Donald Trump aside, Jocelyn Benson, the Secretary of State, released the list of candidates to appear on Michigan's primary ballot. I know some were surprised and consternated that Marianne Williams and Dean Phillips appear on her list. Was there any way she could not include them? Were you surprised?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good point. That's what's so disappointing about this system, because it leaves it entirely to the discretion of the Secretary of State. And the standard is, are they generally advocated by the media to be candidates? What kind of standard is that? Phillips barely announced within the last couple of weeks. Sure, there have been media stories about him. Same thing with Williamson. But really? Putting them on the ballot? I think we need to take a look at this standard for putting people on the ballot. Now, that list, as you, Jeff, from your long experience, that list put out by Benson can be supplemented by the parties. So they have the option of making sure that the people they regard as candidates get on the ballot. But again, this was one of the issues we raised in our lawsuit. How can you vest discretion in the Secretary of State to put an ineligible candidate on the ballot and say the courts can do nothing about it? So I think hopefully after this, we're going to have some fine tuning of this process. Look, I'm a former party chair, nearly 20 years. I respect and defend the role of the parties in these primaries. But there's got to be a little balance here, and certainly the consideration of making sure no eligible candidates get on the ballot. That's got to be a factor.
Sure. Let's turn away from presidential politics and talk about the U.S. Senate primary on the Democratic side. Not necessarily analysis about who is going to win, but there was some news this week by Hill Harper, who is at least been a spirited challenger to Alyssa Slotkin. Maybe that's being generous, spirited, but he did loan his campaign nearly $500,000, it was reported earlier in the fall, but now his financial disclosure statement, his personal financial disclosure statement comes out, and it shows that he really doesn't have finances. He doesn't have a bank account, doesn't have investments, doesn't have any business income. But where does this money come from? It would appear to me, again, here I'll go walking out on thin ice when I make legal analysis, it would appear that this doesn't meet the smell test when it comes to what is legally required for him to disclose.
Yeah, and Jeff, setting aside who should be the Democratic nominee, I'm neutral in that race. Yeah, this is bizarre that he disclosed no assets. Now, I heard this morning that his campaign has now said, we'll amend it, but it's going to take him 3 months. That defeats the whole purpose of transparency. Voters have a right to know now under these forms as to what your assets are, where did you get that $500,000, et cetera, et cetera. I've never seen this from certainly a Senate candidate in Michigan or anywhere else. This is something that would make national news if a wealthy candidate like this filed a form that said, I don't have any assets. But yeah, this is very strange, and it's got to be corrected and corrected soon.
Yeah, because it would seem, this seems at least a little bit parallel to the new Speaker of the House in Washington, Mike Johnson, who also lists on his personal financial disclosure no bank account whatsoever, no retirement account, nothing, no finances whatsoever held in his name. And I know that there is a threshold that appears on, at least once you're in office, that you have to have accounts that have more than $5,000 in them before they're required to be disclosed. But clearly, in the case of Hill Harper, if he's able to provide $500,000 from his own pocket, that has to come from somewhere and not just a box underneath his bed or stuffed inside his mattress.
Yeah, no, this is a real disservice to the voters. And again, I think it will hurt his campaign. People see this kind of conduct. Again, I'm not taking sides here, but boy, if I had a client like that, I'd say, you need to disclose. The law requires it. The public expects it. And you should just comply with it. And if there's problems there, deal with it, right? Be proactive, Jeff, like you and I have always been. On behalf of our respective clients and others, don't hide it, because that just makes it worse.
Yeah. Mark, before we get to the conversation with Stephen Henderson and talk a little bit about your good friend Dan Kildee and his surprise retirement, I wanted to just mention, as we talked about at the intro to this episode, the kind of, I don't know what it amounts to, anti-democratic with a small D move yet again in Ohio to, by the Republican-controlled legislature, to just simply ignore the results of the recent election where Ohio voters chose to enshrine healthcare rights, women's reproductive rights, contraceptive rights in the Ohio Constitution. And just like that same legislature did with regards to the redistricting standards enshrined in their constitution, they just said, we're not going to pay attention to that. We're going to ignore it. How does that fly? Does this require the compliance, the being abetted by a court, a state Supreme Court that just chooses to ignore the constitution as well? How does this happen in America?
It shouldn't. I did hear that the Speaker of the House in Ohio poo-pooed this idea. Hopefully it dies. But you're right, Jeff. What the Republican legislature in Ohio said, fine, you pass this thing, we are going to interpret it as we see fit, and we don't care what the Ohio courts, including the Ohio Supreme Court, cares. That's completely contrary to our legal and constitutional tradition in this country, where it's the courts that declare what the law is and interpret it. That's not the role for the legislature. The legislature can amend a statute, but they can't just arrogate to themselves the interpretation of a state constitution and tell everybody else to go take a hike. If this manages to continue zombie-like, despite what the speaker did, I think there'll be a big confrontation between the legislature and the Ohio Supreme Court over this question. This is a terrible precedent. This is the kind of thing that Trump would do. He would come into office and say, I don't care what the United States Supreme Court says about the constitution. I'm the president. I get to interpret it, and everybody has to live with that. That's not the way we operate in America. That's not the way this democratic republic operates. And I hope we see an end to this thing in Ohio and it doesn't spread any further. But Jeff, I want to engage you here for a minute as well. A few years ago, most people, virtually everybody, was very hesitant to invoke comparisons to Nazi Germany in terms of Trump, what he was doing, what he was saying, etc. And I think rightly, that is such a uniquely horrible incident in human history. People are very reluctant to analogize anything to that. But now we see Trump himself using Nazi rhetoric about how he and his campaign and his people are going to crush fascists and vermin and communists. That sentence could have come out of Hitler's mouth and many other authoritarians over the course of history. So it seems like he now has broken that barrier. And I think it's fair game to start talking about Nazi Germany and what Trump would do if he's reelected.
I think that the time is certainly past to be raising the alarm bells. It is not hyperbole to say that the future of American democracy is at risk if Donald Trump becomes president again. There's been some very recent publicized news about their Project 2025, which is an effort right now being led by several key people in Trump world, including folks like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, to plan for what they would rapidly do when they, if they were to resume power in the White House. They're saying it out loud. They're not keeping it a secret. And this, when people say, how did it happen in Germany? How did it happen there? How did it happen? How does this happen? This is how it happens, because there's never a majority of people that go along with these extrajudicial power grabs, anti-democracy power grabs. Steve Bannon was saying they're going to be rounding up opponents and putting them in Guantanamo. He said that specifically, effectively what amounts to re-education camps and holding camps for their political opponents. They're saying it out loud in the tendency of rational, sane Americans, and there are far more of them than there are Trump Republicans. The tendency is to hear something like that and dismiss it as too absurd, too crazy to ever happen. That's how it happens. It's the apathy, the dismissal of the masses thinking that it can't happen here. As it's happening, these guys aren't being subtle, and we need to wake up and be alarmed. It's time for people to start saying what the stakes are in this election. It's hard to do that without sounding a bit unhinged and a bit crazy. But I think you have to take them at their word. For nearly a decade now, so many people have said, you need to take them figuratively, not literally. And every time that mistake is made, they say, in their actions and deeds, no, you should have listened to us literally, because we will do anything. We have no boundaries. We have no guardrails. We have no limitations, and we will stop at nothing in order to achieve power. It's time for Americans to be scared. There are more of us than there are of them. As long as we vote, we'll be okay. But not just vote, but get active in campaigns. Get active in registering people to vote. Get active in giving to campaigns of your time and your money.
No, you're right, Jeff. We thought Dendocracy was on the ballot in 2020 and even 2022, but it's going to be on the ballot again in 2024. I'm determined by background. I've been to Germany several times. The first concentration camp that Hitler set up after he took power was for his political enemies. So the parallels here just scare me. They really do, when he talks about putting people in camps and then deporting them or whatever else terrible things may happen. We cannot allow that to happen. We cannot be numb to Trump's rhetoric. And I think that's what has happened. And many people have become just so numb to it, they tune it out. But the rhetoric keeps getting worse and worse, more violent, more and more parallels to the horrible atrocities in Nazi Germany and other authoritarian countries. And I hope people will wake up, as you've indicated. I'm not trying to denigrate or criticize folks, but they should be alarmed. And they should use that alarm to take action, to get registered, make sure you get out and vote, but get others out to vote for the candidates, and there will be many on the ballot, who support democracy, not people like Trump and others.
Next, Jeff's conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Stephen Henderson. After these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better.
We have the Ben Franklin hoodie, dedicated to Americans for sanity.
But wait! There's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the Merch Center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
On Thursday, while I was in court battling Trump, Jeff had a wide-ranging discussion on Michigan politics with one of the smartest political journalists anywhere, Pulitzer Prize-winning opinion writer Stephen Henderson. He won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Commentary and the 2014 National Association of Black Journalists Journalist of the Year Award while writing for the Detroit Free Press.
Stephen is the host of Detroit Today, a weekday talk show that features conversations about inequality of all kinds, democratic and civic participation, and great ideas from contemporary books. He is also the host of Detroit Public Television's American Black Journal, a weekly talk show featuring African-American perspectives on topics around arts, culture, and community issues important to the city of Detroit, the state of Michigan, and the nation.
A native of Detroit, Henderson graduated from the University of Detroit Jesuit High School in 1988 and the University of Michigan in 1992. Henderson has worked for the Baltimore Sun, the Chicago Tribune, the Lexington Herald Leader, and Knight Ritter as a reporter, editorial writer, and editor. He was the editorial page editor and a columnist for the Detroit Free Press from 2009 to 2017.
Stephen, how are you? Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's really great to be here. I'm excited to have the conversation.
I know that this is a format that you are familiar with and have operated in for a long time. You have your own podcast and are in the news business for a long time in Michigan, a very familiar name and voice to our listeners. There's a lot going on in Michigan politics, national politics. And big news today is we're recording this on Thursday, the news that Congressman Dan Kildee, somewhat unexpected retirement. He's gone through recent cancer treatments and recovery, but given the dysfunction in Washington, from a personal level, I can understand it. But in terms of the political ramifications, they could be significant.
They really could. First, I would be remiss if I didn't know the deep respect that I have for Dan. I remember meeting Dan when he was the treasurer, county treasurer in Genesee, went up so he could show me what they were doing with the land bank there in Genesee County and trying to get things moving in Flint development. And this was when we were thinking about the land bank in Detroit, thinking that it could help move things along with property management and accessibility and things like that. And I just remember thinking to myself, man, this is a guy who's going somewhere at some point. Just how thoughtful he was about all of those things and the ideas that he had. I was like, he's going to run for something bigger. And of course, the transition to Congress was pretty predictable, I think, and natural given his family history.
Sure.
But I've known Dan for a long time and always had a lot of respect for his work. But you're right. His exit at this point has a lot more political ramifications than it would have four or six years ago. This district that he represents is the old district.
No,
it's nowhere near as Democratic as it was. So it's a seat that automatically goes, I think, into the toss-up column in our state. Let's say it would be in the toss-up column in a normal year. I guess right. I'm not that convinced that Republican.
Yeah, given the stakes, though, the very, very narrowly divided majority that the Republicans have, how close the Democrats are to retaking control, the stakes that one seat could have in the national chessboard, I think we can expect a full court press from both sides and no lack of serious candidates on both sides looking at that. I'm sure there will be candidates out of Genesee County on the Democratic side. I imagine Bill Schuette the younger was already announced something if or or that it will be forthcoming. But there will be, I imagine, other Republicans as well. When I think just off the top of my head, people who live in that district and could wage candidacies, not inclusive by any stretch of the means, but people like Ken Horn, or I can't even, the name of the state rep in Bay County is escaping me right now. But they're one of the no shit caucus. You say, who's that? And there's no, they say they're a state rep. And I go, no shit. But anyway, there's going to be a cast of characters. But this game, and I call it a game because it will be largely, there will be outside interference by the congressional committees in Washington on both sides, trying their best to orchestrate a clear path for a nominee so that and they will have varying degrees of success in doing this as they try. So we'll watch that game all play out. And that's something that our listeners don't always know goes on. This isn't just a come one, come all. Let's see who the last man standing or woman standing is. It's going to be Kristen McDonald Rivett is in that seat. John Cherry the Younger is in that seat. It's a free run. Neither one would have to give up their Senate seat. When it was open once before, a similar seat that included at the time in 1992, the combining of what had been Dale Kildee's, Dan's uncle, and Bob Traxler's seat at the time, some combination thereof. It ended up John Cherry and the senior John Cherry and Jim Barsha ran against each other in a primary back then. And so it's very interesting dynamics that will be going on both parties. There's going to be a lot of things behind the scenes that play out.
Yeah. So the other thing that I think is really important to think of here is you've already gone in the seventh next year. What will be, I think, a really heated competition to replace Alyssa Slotkin, who's going to run for Senate to try to replace Debbie Stabenow. This puts more pressure on both parties, right? And this is a district too far from that. You are already going to have to spend a lot of money to either keep Slotkin's seat Democratic or to flip it. Now you've got to calculate that there's another district in the same state with a lot of the same dynamics because it's the same part of the state where you're also going to have to spend money to either get it or flip it. So that really changes the political landscape next year really dramatically.
Yeah, it really does. And it could have some ramifications potentially on, there could be dominoes that fall as a result of this, depending on who runs under either party. Do state representatives on either the Republican or Democratic side decide, okay, I'm going to take this opportunity that because congressional seats don't come open very often, I'm going to jump into this and give it a shot. And what effect does that have on control of the legislature in Lansing? So there's a whole lot of intrigue that something like this sets off when it occurs, because it is so rare that a member of Congress retires on their own. We've had a spate of retirements in Michigan. We had Dave Trott and Paul Mitchell, both whom only served a couple of terms and said, screw it. You know, I can't, that's not what I signed up for. This craziness in Washington, it was crazy before and it's crazier under Trump. I'm getting out. But the voluntary retirements, they don't come along often. Even last year in 2022, when Fred Upton, who had been for more than 30 years serving, he voluntarily retired, but he did so before he lost a primary. He was, after redistricting, he was going to lose a primary to Bill Huizenga. And okay. So Fred took the easy, honorable way out, saying, I'm not going to go down with a loss on my record. I've never had one. I see the writing on the wall. And so Nothing is forcing Dan, this isn't redistricting forcing Dan to reevaluate. This is just the dysfunction in Washington. And having stared mortality down as he did and seemingly conquered it, says, I'm going to spend the rest of my life not going to Washington every week and watching this craziness take place. I don't blame him, but it could have an effect where ends up empowering the Matt Gaetzes and Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world. It could be the net effect of Dan's decision to retire.
I think that's a lot of it. I think the people who I talk to who win these seats and go for the first time now tell really different stories about their experience than people did just 10 years ago. Congress is much more pugnacious. Look, we saw Republicans almost get a fist fight this week in the building.
Or kidney punch, yes.
That's old school congressional behavior that we haven't seen in a long time. You know, Paul Mitchell and Dave Trott are a really interesting example. These were people who had enough money to be able to stay for about as long as they want. They would have been very hard beats. And both of them expressed to me that they were really excited about getting elected and going to Washington, but they were really disappointed about what they found when they got there. I think there's a lot of mythology about what it's like to be a member of Congress. People think it's this really cool and powerful thing, and it's not. It never was, but now it's not only not that, but it's nasty and bitter. And I haven't talked to Sri Anadar a whole lot about his first 2 years in Washington, but I do wonder what his experience has been like. He certainly is having a hard time adjusting and dealing with constituent concerns back home and stuff like that. And everybody does. But I wonder if the shine is off the apple, right? Like, I wanted this thing. I thought it would be great, but it's really right. Just work.
Sure. And now how the forces are trying to align up to against him to remove him. And I have to go through a tough primary. Am I going to have to do this every 2 years? Is this what I want? Do I want to put myself through this in order to be successful and pay the penalty of then having to serve in Washington, which would seem like almost a punishment as opposed to a reward?
The time it takes to rise through the ranks at this point, to actually have influence in the caucus, is not worth, I think, what a lot of people calculate in terms of value on their side. It's not worth it to be there and be miserable and be traveling back and forth and all this other stuff for this job that grates on you every day. So it'll be interesting to see who raises their hand for this Kildee seat.
Sure. I want to mention one more thing that I've thought of since you were talking about Dan and knowing him a long time and the respect you have for him. It reminds me of, it was just about 10 years ago, it would have been in 2015, maybe 2016, early, I was advising the John Kasich for President campaign. I was still a Republican, and it seems like a lifetime ago to me, but things were still normal. This was, Donald Trump was in the race, but we had no idea. We were all innocent, naive fools who had no idea what the future was going to hold for us. And it was before the Michigan primary in, I think it was March of 2016, and Kasich was coming in to do a bus tour around the state, and Flint water was a big thing at the time. The Flint water and what was going on, it was dominating the news at the time, and didn't know a lot about it. And things being what they were, people were partisan opponents, but not foes and enemies. I reached out through a mutual friend, and Dan Kildee called me. Himself, we didn't know each other. Wow, Republicans and Democrats talking together. And Dan said, I told him what I wanted was, can you get on the phone for 15, 20 minutes with Governor Kasich and tell him your perspective on the Flint water crisis? He wants to hear from somebody on the ground, not somebody from a Republican perspective. He wants the unvarnished truth from a Democrat. And Dan said, I'd be happy to. Anything I can do to help? And it was so normal then, and it seems so strange now. And it's just, how can I help? That seems to be Dan's attitude. He's just a good guy.
Yeah, he really is. And the things he's done for Flint and for the rest of that district, it's really been a great run for him. And he has, I think he has really navigated a lot of the change in Washington really well, right? He's been in the minority way more than he's been in the majority, I think. And he's figured out ways to still deliver by working across the aisle, right? You got to make friends with the people in power, even if they're not in your party, to get things for your district. And he has been, when you think about the delegation and how much influence it has in toto, right? Where are we with seniority and seats, chairmanships, and those kind of things? Dan was a big part of that. And so that's another way this will change, is we're giving up a guy who's been there for more than a decade and we'll start over with somebody new. We're doing that already in a lot of the districts that we have. So
sure. Yeah, there's quite a churn. If we could, let's turn just for a little bit. I'd love to hear your perspective on the way that the U.S. Senate battle, the open seat there, is shaping up on both the Democratic side and the Republican side, which has at least gotten interesting this fall. Let me start. The financial disclosures came out this week for Hill Harper, and I don't know, and I'm still skeptical that he's much of a factor in the Democratic primary against Alyssa Slotkin, but I'd love to hear your perspective if you agree with that, or you think that he could be more of a threat to her nomination than I might.
Yeah, I don't know. I've gotten to know Hill over the last couple of years here in Detroit. We actually live in the same neighborhood. And I have a lot of respect for him. I think it'd be easy to have the impression that he's just an actor and somebody in Hollywood who's just let fame go to his head and now decides, I can do anything, right? I can go run for the U.S. Senate. But if you have a conversation with him about the actual issues, this is a really smart guy. He's a guy who reads a lot. He's a guy with an incredible educational pedigree. He's got a law degree from Harvard, I believe. He's every bit the right person to challenge for this job. I think it's just not going to be his time. I mean, he may be overshooting a bit, right? Because he hadn't been in politics at all. I suggested to him at some point, why not run for a House seat? Why run against Sri Dhanadar, right? That'd be an interesting choice to be able to make. But he really believes that the Senate is where the real work gets done in Washington, and he wants to do that. I do think, though, that Slotkin is so well positioned politically and is so well financed that it's gonna be really difficult for anybody to really challenge her, and especially in political unknown. He's not an unknown because he's an actor, but politically he just does not have a real base to draw from. And even in the city, Bill hasn't spent the time building up political support among Detroiters that you would want to have seen him do before you run for something statewide. So I think he'll struggle, but I also don't think this will be the last time we see him. I think he's got a taste for it and will find something else he wants to run for.
Sure. And on the Republican side, just for your, so you have the background on where I've staked out on this podcast and elsewhere, I've thought that Mike Rogers has had a structural disadvantage in the primary, despite what the gentry establishment class in Washington or even in Michigan might think, that the main capital in the Republican primaries isn't necessarily U.S. currency. It's how crazy and aligned with MAGA and Moms for Liberty and everything else you are. That's a currency that spends as much as television dollars. And Mike is a wonderful candidate in the game that we've all known over the decades, but he is an exceedingly problematic candidate for ill-prepared for the game we're in. And I think James Craig, so far demonstrated in his failed run for governor and even so far in the Senate race, he is not very good at this, but that might not matter. And now with Peter Meyer's entrance into the race, I think that only emboldens or enhances Craig's position, if assuming he is the Donald Trumpish candidate and it's not going to be Nikki Snyder, the Board of Education Moms for Liberty person, which, you know, most people would say, oh, she's way too crazy. That might never say that with the Republicans because you never know what you're going to get. And so that's been my perspective. And I'm not asking you to agree with it, but I would love to know if you have a different perspective, your thoughts on this, because you are a longtime observer of politics in Michigan on both sides, not just Detroit politics. And so I'd love to hear your perspective.
And so I've actually gotten a chance to talk both with Mike Rogers, who I knew when he was in the House, and with Peter Meyer, who I'm still getting to know. It felt like I was getting to know him, and then he had to leave. But he's back. So we've actually had a conversation. I think this is maybe one of the most important races in the Republican Party in the country, right? This is a very clear choice between two very qualified candidates who have a very different take, I think, on the whole Donald Trump dynamic. And they both, I think, are trying to figure out the best way to handle that. I think Rogers is leaning more into the Trump thing than I would have expected him years ago. He seems a little too comfortable with it for my liking, but I get that there's votes there, and he's going to have to, he's got to get them from someplace. Meyer, of course, to impeach Trump when he was in the House, and that helped cost him his seat. This time, he seems to be treading a little more lightly on it and trying not to offend MAGA voters because he needs them too. What people decide in that race, I think, will tell us an awful lot about how much influence that Donald Trump still has on the party next year and what that influence means. It would be really interesting for, I think, if Meyer, taking this kind of softer approach to it and not just coming out and railing against it the way he used to, if he can win that way, maybe that's a path forward for the party. Because I think at the national level, Trump seems to me unlikely to win next year. And that presents all these questions to Republicans about their future. How long do you let this guy who, you know, independent voters who you got to depend on at the national level just are not taking to anymore and they're not interested in following. I don't have any prediction about race. I really think it could be very close. They both will have money. As you point out, they both will have to decide how to spend MAGA currency. I have no idea who comes out on top.
Yeah, and see, my position, I've for a long time worn, I used to wear a Republican campaign advisor hat and would have been advising candidates how to navigate this conundrum, right? How do you position yourself? I left the party because of what I saw, and it really comes down to the appeasement, the accommodation to the crazy, the authoritarian, the corrupt, the anti-democratic, the anti-free and fair elections. And I believe that this, what both Mike Rogers and Peter Meyer are showing, is the same kind of pattern Republicans across the country and in Michigan have shown over this last nearly decade now, of trying to be just enough crazy to appease the crazy voters and just enough normal to, and they end up being nothing to everybody. Peter Meyer is never, ever going to recover from his impeachment vote to those who care about it. And that's about probably a solid 4 in 10 Republican voters. They will never vote for Peter Meyer under any circumstances. No way. Okay. You think, fine, that leaves 60% of the out there. He's automatically behind the eight ball with those people because they're still adjacent to Donald Trump. It's not just Donald Trump. This has exposed something, a far further rot, or the cancer has spread far beyond Donald Trump, and it will exist if Donald Trump disappears tomorrow. The crazy won't go away. But it seems to me that the only real lane, and it might have been an implausible one that could have yielded victory, was for Meyer to just own his position. I voted against Trump. It's time to say enough is enough and try to attract enough people, let Rogers and Craig sort it out and just say, I'm the only one who's going to tell it like it is. I voted that way in January of 2021 when I voted, or February when I voted to impeach him. There's a clear difference between me and everybody else. Now he's just trying to be effectively Mike Rogers light with a more recognizable name to Michigan voters. Mm-hmm. And so they both have armed services background, Mike Rogers law enforcement background that he leans into, but it's now, I think, a demerit to many Republican voters and maybe a majority of Republican voters who spent the last several years being conditioned by their media ecosystem to dislike the FBI.
Yeah.
So that's been Mike's identity as an elected official. I was an FBI agent. I was this Elliot Ness character. And before that, I was in the U.S. Army. And so he was this real life action figure. But now those are things that they're not pluses for. They would be pluses in a general election, but he's got to get past August. And I can tell there's a schizophrenic messaging coming from his campaign that I'm watching on social media, where one day he's talking about, we need to stop the politicization at the FBI. They're bad people now. but here I am as an FBI agent. I was a good guy. And so yeah. I don't think he's going to be able to thread that needle. And trying to be both things to all people isn't going to work.
Yeah. When I interviewed Mike, I asked him about his criticism of the FBI and his criticism of the current cases against Donald Trump. And what I was trying to get to was whether he believes that there is really nothing there, that there's nothing that this former president has done that's worthy of investigation. And again, kinds of people get investigated by the FBI for all kinds of things, right? It's not a high threshold there. I think you think of a dozen things that Donald Trump did that's worth looking into. He got upset with me for pushing him on that. And he snapped at me and said, what I hear from inside the Bureau is that this is all too politicized. And I said, okay, but that's not really the question I'm asking. I want to know what you think. You were an agent. Would you not look into any of those things? He didn't want to answer that question. I think that's going to be problematic for him in the general. It won't in the primary.
Yep. I've known Mike since 1995 when he was first in the state Senate. Used to know him fairly well. He was irritated. I'll tell you, some people might say, you don't know what he's actually thinking. I know what he's thinking. He didn't want to answer that question because he doesn't believe it. He knows every word coming out of his mouth about Donald Trump is bullshit. He knows Donald Trump is guilty as hell. He's corrupt. He's dangerous, but he doesn't dare say it. And he's frustrated by that because he can't say it and have any chance to win. He's painted into a box and he knows it. And so he's never going to give anybody the straight answer on that. But I think anybody who is a rational, thinking, sentient human being knows that Mike Rogers is bullshitting when he obfuscates on that answer.
And how do you do that? How do you get people to vote for you if they think you're lying or playing to a particular group?
Yeah. The voters aren't going to. And if he takes this position in order to prevail in the primary, he's now stuck with that. He's not going to be able to say, I was just bullshitting during the primary. I didn't really believe it. Now vote for me because I'm sane and rational Republican like the old guys. That's the conundrum that the Republicans have. And they think that they can somehow walk this fine line. And every shred of evidence over nearly the last decade now is you can't do that. They've allowed the rot to fester and manifest itself across the body politic of the Republican Party because no one has stood up to this and said enough and it's wrong. And whether it was Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan back in 2017 or Mike Rogers and Peter Meyer in the Michigan Senate battle in 2024, this is just allowing it to continue by thinking you can nod and wink your way past it and that everyone's going to get the joke that you're going to be different if you're elected and if you're empowered to do it. You're going to fall under you're going to be under their thumb the same way these other people are. Afraid to take them on.
What's happening, I think, the thing that if I had to cast out to next November, the thing that Republicans are going to have to worry about is this rot that you're talking about is killing their effectiveness at the things that they can actually control, right? You've had control of the House now for 11 months, and can't think of the guy's name, the Texas congressman who was
Chip
on the floor.
Chip Roy.
Name one thing, he says, that we've done, and we can go back to voters and say, hey, we did, so that they vote for us. Again, that is the question that voters ask themselves when they go vote. And this dysfunction that is related to this question of Trump, this is the wrong time of year for that to still be taking hold, right? People are starting to pay attention. They're starting to think about next year. Republicans don't have a lot to show for what they did have control of. It's going to be hard to sell a message to give them more at the ballot.
I agree. I worry that there's enough dysfunction or wish casting on the Democratic side and on the media looking for a horse race. The notion, delusion that there's still somehow going to be a race that doesn't include Donald Trump and doesn't include Joe Biden. That's just people are in this delusional space right now. You see the polls that 70% of independents want another candidate. So Joe Manchin and Larry Hogan are looking at running as the no labels. Nobody else is going to be president other than the choice is, I think, is going to come down to Donald Trump or Joe Biden again. And that's the reality. And the sooner people realize and come to grips with that and stop trying to create this unicorn fabled magical candidate that's not going, that's going to come and change American political culture, the sooner we can align behind it. But God forbid somebody like Dean Phillips do what Gene McCarthy did back in 1968 to Lyndon Johnson. He didn't win, he didn't come close, but he got enough that everyone said, "Hold!" And Johnson dropped out of the race in February or March of 1968. And while just to, let's jump ahead to the next spring, Donald Trump is going to be consolidating his hold. Formalizing his hold. It's already there. The reality will set in. Oh my God, he's actually going to win the nomination. And if the wheels come off the Democrats and somehow Joe Biden isn't the nominee and we're now, what do we do? And we're going to wait until the convention. That's the recipe for disaster, a 1968 style free for all with a lot higher stakes. Because Hubert Humphrey, and for all of Nixon's fault, we weren't facing the threat of authoritarianism. It was still, he was just a normally corrupt politician as opposed to
and nobody in 68. So this is maybe a crazy idea or opinion. I actually don't think that Joe Biden is going to be the Democratic. I think really? There are a lot of signs that suggest this is a guy who knows he can't even do the campaign, let alone do another 4 years in office. I think the problem is that he does not have a vice president that he has confidence in her ability to win. If he were to step out now, then there would be a primary fight. He feels like that would be chaotic. And I think it's about timing. I think as someone I know has floated this idea that he will step out at the convention. That he will say, "I can't do this. I thought I could. I want to, but I'm not able to. And so I'm not going to accept the nomination," which would open up a floor fight, which could be ugly for a couple of days, but it's not ugly for 8 months, is what we're faced through a primary. And then, of course, if you do that at the convention, favors California and Californians in a way that the primaries wouldn't at a number of votes.
And Newsom, sure.
So someone like Gavin Newsom maybe becomes more of a favorite. I think Gretchen Whitmer could be in the mix for something like that. I think that's one of the biggest political surprises ever in Michigan. Those of us who've known her long time have guessed that we were talking to her in those terms. But sure. I think something like that is at least possible. It's not like.
That's fascinating for me as a longtime presidential political junkie. The presidential politics has been a passion of mine since I could talk nearly. I remember the 1972 election as a small child and caring about it. And so that's fascinating from that perspective. Wow, that would be cool to see. But it is frightening as somebody who thinks that we're teetering on the edge of an abyss when it comes to our position as a stable democracy I've said this before, I'm going to keep saying it as long as I have this microphone, that the strength of our democracy never comes from the size of the majority. It comes from the losing side, the minority's willingness to accept the results. And if Donald Trump wins the election, he's going to do so not by winning a majority of the votes. He will not. That's just a guarantee. He will done so through our electoral college system, which, granted, is the rules of the game, but it's going to be a very hard pill for the majority of voters to swallow that a second time around, knowing what happened the first time. And that's where I fear the wheels come off. And the next January 6th includes radicalized activists on both sides of the political spectrum.
Both sides. Yeah, no, I think, boy, if Trump wins again, even if it's just an electoral college win, I do think you're right that the wheels might come off. That would, by the way, be the third time that's happened in 24 years.
Right. Recall.
That's not what the design was, right? I don't think who helped put the system together would have imagined that would happen frequently, if ever. it also, I can't think of another point in our history where you've seen a party lose the popular vote at the national level as often as the Republican Party has in the last 35 years or so, and continue to be a part, right?
Right.
It happens, and then they go away, and something else replaces it. And I think there's something really interesting about the resistance to that idea on the right, right? What is the next thing? What, obviously, what they're doing is not, it's working in some ways, right? It works at the state level. They still have massive control because of the way that things work in state politics and in the Senate. It's a going concern that way, but it's not on a national level. And at what point does it become imperative to do something else? And what is that?
Right.
And Trump winning, losing, but winning again would really, again, I think I like that question. Is this a functioning political party at a national level?
No, I think you're right there. And I pray that you're right on your statement earlier that you don't think he's going to win. I don't think he will either, but I fear that he might. And because it seems to be the perfect storm lining up, there's so many factors. Hopefully, you would think, knowing what we know about the economic reality, that by next year, those numbers will have caught up in the public perception, the reality of people's own lives and how things like inflation and economic and wage growth are impacting them. They lag behind the good reports that come out. People don't say, oh, wow, great report. My wallet feels better. They have to wait till they see it in their entry cart and in their gas tank and in their paycheck. And every indication is that will happen, but there's so much instability. You know, we have two wars that we are involved in while not fighting that could escalate in any number of fashions. And it's the unknown, the X factor that's looming out there. What's next? What don't we know that could impact? And it could a Biden health scare, another international crisis on top of this, an escalation, an unexpected escalation of one of the existing crises. That would be gas on a fire at the time. And that's the 1968. The more I think about this, there's a lot of 1968 parallels. Now, granted, we're not sending lower income American boys overseas to go fight in a war that people are starting to question in serious ways. We don't have that dynamic, but we have a lot of other domestic strife. I think you could say every bit as tense or maybe more volatile, or certainly no less volatile than we had in 1968. And it's 1968, 1860, another. This is a watershed election. Everyone, the most important election of our lifetime. Yes, this will be one of those ones that they look back and say, this is when America either got itself back on track, or this is when the wheels came off. That's what we're looking at over the next. We got 51 weeks minus 2 days. It's going to be very interesting. And I look up here at my clock and I see, holy crap, we've gone a long time and longer than we told you we would keep you. And so we need to wrap this up, but tell our listeners where they can find you online on socials and also on the airwaves.
So you can find me on Twitter, SH Detroit, X. I don't know. Are we calling it X now?
I call it Twitter.
I can't make that transition. You can find me on Facebook as well. Those are the two platforms that I use the most. And you can always go to WDET, of course, to find the podcast radio show we broadcast every morning from 9 to 10. On NPR in Detroit and Detroit Public Television, where I host a couple television shows as well.
Stephen Henderson, thank you very much for your insight and your observations on Michigan politics and the national conundrum we find ourselves in. And we look forward to having you back as a guest sometime.
Yeah, I was going to say, we got to do this again as we get closer to all these. This was fun.
All right. Thank you.
That's a wrap for this week. Before we conclude, a reminder, the perfect Christmas gift for the never-Trumper in your life is our new Tribute to 91 Felonies mugshot mug, available at our merch store.
It's a tasteful coffee mug featuring accused serial criminal Donald Trump's Atlanta mugshot, along with the admission that he surrendered 4 times. You can get it right now. Go to our merch store on our website at republicpodcast.com.
And with that, we bid you adieu for another week. Our great thanks to Stephen Henderson for joining us.
Our wish for you is the happiest Thanksgiving without any political violence at the dinner table, so you can fully enjoy Alliance victory. If the Republic is still standing, we'll return next week.
A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.